over these weeks since the beginning of January, we've been at the beginning of the service gathered around the entry area, and I've poured water in that beautiful blue ceramic bowl and invited people, if they wished, to touch the water as a reminder of their being claimed by God as beloved. And it's a practice that's rooted in the text about Jesus' own baptism, God claiming Jesus as beloved. And for those of us who've been baptized, it's our opportunity to recollect that. But I just want to also acknowledge that it's not given in baptism, that belovedness. It's something that's given to us in our createdness. And so then we have the opportunity to recollect that, to recollect that through baptism. And so it's something that's just a part of our creatureliness, that we are made of clay and of breath, and that in a sense is the fundamental blessing, the belovedness that comes from being beautifully made by God. And yet it's not that straightforward to claim that, even if we say God counts us as beloved and we have friends and hopefully friends and maybe congregants who tell us that. And I was in conversation with a congregant this past week who was just reflecting on that practice at the beginning of the service. And they said to me, you know, I believe God thinks I'm beloved, and I know you all do at St. Lydia's, but it's really hard for me to accept myself as beloved. And so I was just holding that this week as I thought about this sermon and this text and the ways in which that's not been straightforward for me to hold. I was thinking about this one particular experience I had maybe, I don't know, a decade ago. I've gone every year for maybe 15 years to a Benedictine Abbey in northern Minnesota called St. John's Abbey. And I go there partly for spiritual retreat and partly to meet with a group of colleagues who gather to read and write together. And there's an old, it's not that old, there's a church where the monks meet to pray during the day. They pray in the morning, at noon, in the afternoon, in the evening. And it was built in the style of Vatican II. If you know about the changes in the Catholic Church in the 60s, they reoriented their theology and moved the congregation more around the altar instead of having the altar up against the wall. So it anticipated that, and it's built that way. And so there's a section behind the altar where the monks' choir is, and then there's the place where the congregation sits. But when you go for morning prayer, everyone's invited to go sit up in the choir with the monks. And I went early, so I was there. It was like 6:30 in the morning, dark. The monks weren't there yet. They kind of like shuffle out at 6:59. Yes. And so sitting there in the dark, and I was in this place, you know, I was in a job that it was grant funded. I'm an academic, you know, I was at a university, it was grant funded. So I knew it was not gonna last. I'd applied for some jobs, and it was like that situation where you send in your application and then you wait and you don't get a phone call. You're like, oh, I didn't make it over the first hurdle, okay. So I didn't really know what was gonna happen, and I was feeling like, okay, great, I spent all this, like a decade doing graduate school, and now I have no job prospects. So I'm sitting there, not feeling that great about myself, not knowing what's going to happen next. And all of a sudden, like this has never happened before, it's never happened since, but I heard so clearly this voice speak to me, Christian, you are enough. And I was like, you know, I kind of did what the disciples did, except I didn't fall down because I was already sitting down. But I was like, okay, wow. So I just, you know, it's one of those things that you put in your front pocket and you carry with you. And yeah, I had, I think, a hard time accepting that. I think for a couple of reasons. One, you can fill in the blank on your own stories in this respect, but you know, partly was like this, I don't know, story of my dad on my shoulder and never meeting his expectation. And, you know, him always like being the sort of judgmental. I sometimes joke my dad had two emotions, distant and angry. And they were both judgments. Right? One was the soft judgment of like, show me you can do it. And the other one was the angry, you didn't do it. But then there are like these cultural stories too that tell me I'm not enough. Like I don't have, you know, six pack abs, or I don't have the right salary, or I don't have the right like cool things on my resume or whatever. Our culture has a lot of pretty strong stories about what it means to have enough or to be enough, which judge us. Like we walk around, I think, and imbibing those from early in our lives. So, you know, I, like many people, try and do my work around that. I have a great therapist, and I address my father issues, and I try and like be okay with myself in relationship to the cultural stories. But there are lots of days when it feels sort of self-doubty in my mind and heart, and like I'm more not making it than making it. So I just found myself realizing it's really important to think through what it means actually to answer for myself what the St. Lydia's congregant said to me. Like the most profound one of those is that I have to say to myself, I'm beloved. And if I don't say that, it's really hard for me to accept you think I'm beloved or that God thinks I'm beloved. So I was thinking about the way Jesus works with the law and the prophets, his teachings, and how he summarized them all by saying, love God and love your neighbor as yourself, and how so often that gets interpreted in that order. Like, you know, there's this God thing that happens, and then there's others, and you're last. And it really just is so clear to me that it's the reverse. It has to be the reverse. Like, if I don't experience myself as beloved, then it's very hard actually to love others, let alone love God, or to know that others love me or that God loves me. And so I wanted to just take a moment, a little exercise for ourselves in playfulness around that, because ultimately, you don't get somewhere by trying to get to the destination. You get somewhere by taking a step. And sometimes a playful step is a way to sort of do an end run again around the hard stuff. So you all have paper and markers on your table, and I want you to pick some. There's colored pencils, there's fat markers, there's skinny markers. So just pick some colors you like and get a blank piece of paper. I think there should be six on each table. Yeah. And the first thing I'm gonna do is just give you an assignment to write two sentences. And this is one of those things where the teacher claims his power and you just have to do it. So the first sentence is, I am enough, period. Just however you want to write it, however you want to mix colors or use one color. I am enough, period. The second sentence is, I am beloved, period. I like the period because that means it's a complete sentence. No buts, no like continuation. It's just a declarative statement. So keep your pens and paper because there's some more assignments for you in just a minute. But this text about the Transfiguration is pretty wild and weird. There's a lot of stuff going on in it. And there's a lot of things you could pay attention to. Like one of the nerdy facts that I think is fascinating is Transfiguration, the Greek word for that is metamorphosis, which is what butterflies do when they go in the chrysalis. they metamorphize, and yeah. So there's this like.
So they turn themselves to goo.
Goo, exactly. Jesus is goo in this text. It's in a sense this beautiful moment of his transformation into who he needs to be for his ministry. Like the next thing that happens is he goes down the mountain and runs into this person who's ill and heals them. Like he goes right to work in this transformed place that he's in. But there's lots of weird things, like the tent thing is weird. There's a lot of interesting things, but I really focused in on this sentence that appears here. And it also appears at his baptism earlier in Matthew's gospel. And interestingly, the same exact thing God says shows up in Mark's gospel, the exact same thing. It shows up in Luke's gospel. Like again and again, they portray God as saying the exact same thing at this moment. And so that to me is like an interesting thing. Like, how come everyone heard the same thing? Maybe that's what happened. I don't know. It's worth just looking at the words, the Greek words. I don't know if God spoke Greek or not, but, you know, could be.
It's all Greek.
But Matthew wrote it in Greek, and the words are hautos esten hoihos mu ho agapetos. And literally it's, this is the son of me, the beloved. And it's that last word in Greek that I think is really important to pay attention to. Every single one of the versions of this in all the Gospels uses that same word, agapetos, which is agape, like that's the word. And in this adjective version of it, it has a number of meanings. So this is another place where you get an assignment. If any of these meanings of the adjective agapetos strike you, write them down. So it can mean these things, beloved, of course, that's how it's translated in the text. It can also mean dear, like you're dear to me. It can mean you're desirable, delightful, lovable. So going back to the sentence, this is my son, my child, the beloved, the dear one. The desirable one, the delightful one, the lovable one, all of those. And then one more thing about that word, which I think is really fantastic, it has the connotation of something that's a gift that you can't work for. There's nothing you can do. It's conferred. It's just given. And it's given on the basis of you being, not doing anything. So there's this really fundamental quality of it as gift that you receive. You receive this conferral of who you are in this sort of group of words. It's almost like a word, what's that called? When you take a bunch of words and then there's this computer program that goes, whew.
Oh yeah, the
compiler.
No, but there's like
a word design. Map.
The visual word?
A word.
Mm-hmm. Like a word bubble or word map.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're like all the words are all of a sudden there.
Yeah.
That's what you're creating.
Yes.
A wordle. Word cloud.
Syntax.
Mind map.
That's what you're creating. All of those things. and there's one more thing that I think is beautiful in the language of this section of the text, which is like when God speaks this to Jesus, if the disciples weren't already sort of in awe before this, they are at this point. It sort of, you know, throws them over the edge and they fall down shocked and afraid. They're afraid. They're fearful about all these things and especially this voice. And Jesus says to them, get up, do not be afraid. Like, I love that. It's like he calls them back to their agency, to their humanity, to their participation in this belovedness, and says, don't be afraid. Like this is a space of gift and goodness and blessing. So what happens in this text and what this text does in our midst and in our lives and in our bodies is says to each of us, you are beloved. You are enough. And You don't have to be afraid of all the demons that are standing on our shoulders and shouting or whispering in our ears saying that we're not beloved or not beautiful or not the right way, whatever that is. And that in this fundamental sense, as bodies that are clay and breath, that are soul and body, that we are beloved. And doing the work of writing it down, each one of us for ourselves, lets us name that for ourselves. This is last night's. Just sitting here speaking back to us. And yours, I hope now, sitting on the table speaking back to you. I'll leave just a moment of silence and then ring the bell to call us back and invite a few stories or experiences from you that this might have evoked.